Members of Parliament, Senators, Your Excellencies, honored guests. Good afternoon and welcome to our annual policy conference. My name is Dave Quist and I have the pleasure of being the Executive Director for the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. The Institute is your resource for social policy analysis and commentary. In the 3 years that we've had our doors open, we've been a part of hundreds of media interviews. We've commented on each of the federal budgets since that time. We've contributed to the House of Commons and Senate committees, deliberations on several different topics of interest to families and marriage, and the importance of their role in our society today. It's my belief that we cannot look at social and fiscal policy exclusively from each other. Changes to one will undoubtedly affect the other. One of the primary differences, however, is we tend to see results on fiscal policy much more quickly than we do on social policy. With the GST rate change of several years ago, if you purchased a new washing machine the next day, you probably would have seen a savings of $30 into your pocket. Other forms of economic stimulus that governments are undertaking worldwide are striving to implement today, positive outcomes in the short term. Unfortunately, this cannot be true of social policy. We don't often know what the outcomes will actually be, and we don't often see the outcomes for some time down the road. In 1968, when Canada introduced no-fault divorce, the rationale was that we would have something called good divorces, that it would be a positive experience. Sadly, we've come to recognize there is no such thing as a good divorce. Children are hurt, moms are hurt, dads are hurt. The amount of pain may vary, but it still exists. Today we know that what was thought to be one thing in 1968 has turned out to be quite something else today. On another matter, the leading edge of the baby boomers are about to retire. In the years ahead, we'll have more people moving into retirement than we've ever seen before. Unfortunately, we also have fewer children that are being born and therefore fewer taxpayers when our nation's health care costs go through the roof. Our views on demography and an overpopulated planet are now resulting in a very different story, both socially and fiscally. Our government recognized common law marriages as the same as married couples and offered tax credits, thus rewarding cohabitation. Social science research is clearly showing that cohabitation is not the same as marriage. And the result? A steady increase and rise in cohabitation so that approximately 17% of couples in Canada and an amazing 35% in Quebec are living cohabitating. If we look at younger age groups especially, those numbers close to double again. But there are consequences. Children raised in a married heterosexual family fare better on almost every indicator. Lower rates of depression and mental health. Higher rates of success in education and income. Lower rates of vandalism, substance abuse, and early sexual encounters. Higher highs and lower lows. And so the data continues to roll in on subjects like this. The IMFC accepts the task of communicating this information out to the public square, to our politicians, to our media, our business and community leaders, to the people like you sitting in this very room. And how do we do this? Well, in your folders that you picked up at the door at registration today, you'd have seen a sampling of a number of different things there. You'd have seen a sample of our e-review, which is a bi-weekly newsletter that comes out every 2 weeks, of course, bi-weekly, that is an in-depth look at one particular topic. It varies, it tries to stay current, the issues that are actually on your schedule and on your agenda right now. You'll also find a copy of our latest research, Growing Up Married, Growing Up Common Law. Have a look at that. That's the latest research that was just released tomorrow, actually, and is on its way out to many different mailings all across Parliament Hill and across the nation as well. These policy papers appear 10 times a year as an in-depth analysis of social policy issues that are all around us. Also on our website, you're going to see a bookmark. And on it, you'll see two different links. One is to our regular website, and the black and white side is a link to familyindex.net. a searchable social database of close to 4,000 different academic articles. If there's an issue that you're looking, if you're doing research, if you're looking for writing material, if you're doing journalism, if you're a student, that's a database you need to be aware of and using. It's there for free of charge. It's there for your use. Those are largely Canadian, but there is an international flavor to it as well. Topics involving family, parenting, crime and violence, family economics, and a host of other topics as well. I'm also pleased to announce a new product that's on our website as of today, a product called QuickStats. So on the left-hand side of our main webpage, click on there, and you'll see a series of different one-page, two-page, short bullet point information sets on given topics. The one that's in your catalog today is cohabitation statistics. As we add more, you'll find more there for your use as well. They're simply put, they're there for a quick look on any given topic. If you're looking for more information and don't see it, send us an email, give us a phone call. We will be glad to assist you with whatever we can there as well. If you'd like to receive regular updates of our resources, please use the bottom of your evaluation page. There's some blanks there for name, address, phone number, email addresses. We'd love to keep you up to date. We'd like to have your feedback on what information you're looking for. As we look at the world around us, and the fast-paced change, not all of it good, it's our considered opinion that we must find new solutions to unresolved old problems. The old methods have largely not worked, and to continue down those paths is foolhardy and unnecessarily expensive. And that's why I'm pleased to have the Right Honorable Ian Duncan Smith with us today. He has had and maintains one foot in the political world, being elected since 1992. He has the other foot firmly planted in the social policy world through the Center for Social Justice. And that reality exists in the tough parts of many of the cities in the United Kingdom. Following a six-year military career, which culminated the rank of captain with the Scots Guards, Mr. Duncan Smith has been a member of Parliament, as I mentioned, since 1992, including 2 years as leader of the British Conservative Party. In 2004, he founded the Centre for Social Justice, a think tank, what he refers to as a do tank, and I think you're going to see why in just a few minutes. The Centre's aim is to, quote, study the causes and consequences of poverty in Britain and seek practical ideas to empower the least well-off. Which brings us to our time with him today. He has successfully worked to find solutions. Solutions not based on the bottomless money pits or red tape-laden bureaucracy. Rather, it's involved local community groups, faith groups, individuals, volunteers, groups that work at the grassroots level. Those people and groups that can and are making a difference. This is not a partisan solution to social justice issues. Single-parent moms and dads, welfare recipients, substance abusers, homeless men and women need real solutions to their very real problems. Eradicating child poverty is a noble goal. But let us not forget that behind every child in poverty is a family in poverty. We need to address the roots of the issue, not just the symptoms. I'm eagerly waiting to hear what he has to bring us today. This morning, the House of Commons Standing Committee on Human Resources, Skills, and Social Development also wanted to hear what he had to say. I believe that was time well spent. I think the committee members thought so at that time as well. Will you please welcome the Right Honourable Ian Duncan Smith.
Thank you very much indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Can I start by thanking General Institute for Marriage and Family here in Canada for organising this particular conference and for inviting me to address it. As you know, I've already spoken to you about this. I admire the work that you've been doing personally and all the many dedicated people that I've seen involved in your organisation. I have to say to everybody here two things. One is to elicit some sympathy and the other is to mislead you. When I was talking today about this yesterday, I said roughly how many people will there be in the room that I'm addressing, and he said it depends. I said, what, depends on the speaker? He said, no, depends on the food. And he didn't tell me what he meant by that. Was the trick to get them into the room was to give you all a plate full of food and have you eat it. So I'm sorry that I'm competing with the most important thing in your life to talk about the second most important thing in your life, and I promise not to be long. And as I'm a politician, if you believe that, then you'll believe anything, frankly. So thanks for that. The second thing is that this is the sympathy bit. I haven't actually eaten yet, so I'm going to be as quick as I possibly can and then listen to Jennifer later on while I eat. So I'm terribly sorry, Jennifer, if you see me munching at the back of the room. It's because my body's finally given out. Again, let me thank you all for being, for inviting me here. And I think this is very timely here, this conference. I think it's timely generally that this sort of discussion takes place. We've entered a period of very deep-rooted economic instability, not just in an individual country, but across the world, it appears. The loss of jobs and the repossession of homes are more than economic, though. I keep telling everybody they are hugely personal. They are family issues as much as they are about money. The tendency amongst broadcasters is to report these things in purely economic terms, but there is social capital to be recalled in all of this. And at such a moment, I think it's vital to consider the importance, therefore, of the family, what is happening to the family, and what will happen to the family. And I believe to put it back once again at the heart of society and, it must say, at the heart of politics. So it's therefore a privilege today to come and speak to you all about families, poverty, and what I term as social justice, very much from the British perspective. But let me put this in context. As the former leader of the British Conservative Party, I recognise that poverty and social justice have for decades been the preserve, it seems, in our debates of the political left. Now, the left in politics were considered instinctively compassionate, and still are. Conservatives invariably are condemned often as finger-wagging moralisers, obsessed with toughness and devoid of any real compassion. Perhaps sometimes the accusation runs that you know the price of everything but the value of nothing. And that is an important feature in terms of the critique. And sometimes there's some basis to this view. Many conservatives, from my standpoint, declared that they simply didn't do social justice. And social justice was seen as a left-wing term. And almost invariably I end up with exactly the same commentary, and I'm sure they're going to be in the room today, that you will cite Hayek's critique that social justice is, of course, a purely contradictory notion. After all, social society is collective and justice is individual, and there the twain should meet. Well, I suppose in entomological terms, that's absolutely correct. But I'm afraid I'm not going to deal with it in terms of the pure politics or in terms of absolute meanings of words. Because I have realised that most of the British people that I have to communicate with haven't probably ever heard of Hayek, probably can't spell it, and may not even be aware of any analysis. Doesn't mean to say that it isn't vital, but it's just to say that sometimes when we're communicating with people, we need to understand where they're coming from, not where we wish they were. Public polling that we then conducted when I wanted to set up the centre found that social justice actually resonated with the vast block of the public who weren't what I might refer to as political junkies. Political junkies, by the way, are people that watch political programmes. Sorry. And attend political speeches. However, it meant a great deal. These are the people that sway elections one way or the other. They're the people that make the mass of the people that vote, and they're the people that decide who shall be in power. Just a little point, but it's always worth remembering that. what our polling revealed very extensively was that when you asked the general public about social justice, it actually left them really with a warm feeling. It left them with a sense that this was something that was good. They didn't strangely dwell on that Hayekian definition. But what they did was when we asked them to define it and gave them a series of definitions that they could choose from, we put in everything too, from more benefits, more payments, more help in the sense of money for various groups of people. The phrase that they actually picked, over 70% of them, was that help for those who genuinely need help and help for those who deliver the help. Now, I would put it to you that that is not a an ideological position, that is not a political position, that is not one thing that can direct you to the idea that these people who said that social justice mattered, over three quarters of the public that we polled, were actually on the left at all, or on the right either. They were just people. And they heard a phrase which they knew, which had sunk into their psyche, and it meant something. What did it mean? It meant something about them. If you believed in social justice, then you were likely to be decent people. And as they thought they were decent people, they believed in social justice. Sometimes it does us good to remember that, rather than to dwell and debate too often on the absolute meaning of words. So in this context, in 2004, I established the Centre for Social Justice after stepping down as leader of the British Conservative Party. My organisation, I stress at this point, is independent and works with anybody who wants to dwell on the values-based process that we're talking about, whether they be on the left or on the right or of no particular political persuasion. Furthermore, as Dave said earlier on, we're not a typical think tank. We do other things apart from the classic evidence-taking and publication. Whilst we seek policy solutions, and I'll come back to those in a second, for those challenges facing our most disadvantaged communities, and I think we've managed to put some of these right at the heart of the debates in British politics today, what makes my organisation, the Centre for Social Justice, unique is our practical partnership with organisations that are changing the lives around their communities that no one has ever heard of. We have formed a thing called the Poverty Fighters Alliance, which is made up of small community groups from the inner cities, over 200 at the moment, hopefully rising to 500. These are champions of the work that is most effective in their communities. Some of them are very innovative, they've come up with new ideas, but they are essentially grassroots, voluntary sector organisations that are around Britain, living and working and made up of the people who are of those communities that they work in. I can think of many even as I stand here, and I'll come back to some of those. But this alliance gives these charities, community groups, a voice. It allows them to come together at Westminster. We give them an opportunity to express their views about public policy, to tell us what's going right, what's going wrong, and to tell us where the problems are. It also makes annual financial awards on the back of an awards program to those organisations who are the most interesting, and every year we give out, this year, about £70,000 specifically to organisations that I'm talking about. So this practical element to our work is, I think, the heartbeat of what we do. It's the most important part of what we do, because what we do is inspired by these organisations who work with Britain's most broken communities. They are led by what I would refer to as social entrepreneurs who every day are dedicated to transforming lives. Some of the most inspiring people I have ever met are in these communities. I have no idea what politics they have at all, if they have any politics. But what I do know is that they grasp the scale and the nature of our problems, our social breakdown, what leads to it and what gets them out of it. But they also are engaged every day in trying to pick up the pieces and reverse it. I can think of such organisations, and one comes to mind now, which is called Save the Family, which is an organisation in North Wales working in a very difficult community, a community that's quite run down with a very high level of social breakdown and deprivation. This organisation was started by a woman, a nursery school teacher, who every day she came to work found herself dealing with children who were simply not school ready, who struggled to learn, and who she struggled with, and their lives were quite damaged. And she set up this organisation to try and help children like this, and she came up with a unique idea. She told me one day that in actual fact we spend our whole time focusing on dysfunctional families and lifting children off those dysfunctional parents or parent and taking them into care, into state care. That would, if it wasn't funny, would be a joke, the idea of state care, and I'll come back to this in a second. But the point that she made is that actually if you take one child, you might save that child. But if you take the mother, you save the family. And the point about saving the family is the simple fact that many of those mothers will go off and have more children. And if their lives are still blighted and abused, and if they are ignorant in the way that they are, and they are in difficult relationships, then their next child will become just as difficult as the child that you took off them. And just guess what happens then? because we take the next child off them as well. One of the mothers I met there had over 5 children. 2 were already adopted. She'll never see them again. 2 were in care. 1 was about to be adopted. And the last one was a small baby that she had before they took her in. So the point about organizations like that, like Eastside Young Leaders Academy, which takes in young, underperforming Afro-Caribbean boys in the inner city of southeast London, who have, many of them, been incredibly violent, aged 8 or 9. Some of them have taken knives to their teachers. They work with them to support them in schools. They act, in a sense, as the father figures in their lives, turning them around. In that group, we've seen the first ones go off to university. Some of them are going off to private schools on scholarships. Almost unheard of for these children. This is real practical help and assistance, and they tell us the need to do certain things. So for too long, what they tell us is that the issue of poverty has only been about money. What we have learned from these organizations is that the nature of the life that you lead has a huge bearing on your financial status, or for that matter, what you can do with your money and whether it is effective. It's through these poverty fighters that we have learned of the 5 common drivers of poverty, and that's what we did our work on. But we call these pathways to poverty, and I want to outline the key principles about them shortly. They are essentially educational failure, economic dependency and worthlessness, serious personal indebtedness, addiction and family breakdown. These pathways are central to understanding social breakdown and also central to the concept of poverty, and finally central to the solutions to poverty and social breakdown. And second, these groups demonstrated, these voluntary groups, that the solutions exist, that the reversal of breakdown is possible beyond the state, and that in many cases the state has actually made matters worse. So it seemed to me that in society in the UK it becomes slightly, well, in some areas, very much unbalanced. There's too much entrenched poverty in the UK, a country, 4th largest economy in the world. I can go to parts of Glasgow where our poorest people have life expectancies lower than, for example, in the Gaza Strip. I know of 2 areas, Carlton and Gallagate, that I've visited on many occasions, just to take Glasgow as an example, where the average life expectancy is in the early 50s. If I walk 7 miles away from there, the life expectancy is 82. So I should be angered, we should all be angered, to learn of the nearly 1.4 million children who also have drug and alcohol addicted parents, brought home to me by the story of 2 young schoolboys that I was aware of when I was up in Easterhouse. These 2 young kids, one was 8, one was 6, every morning in what had become a shockingly deprived estate. By the way, it was built in the 1960s to house the shockingly deprived people from the Gorbals in Glasgow. Inspired 30 years, it's become shockingly deprived as well, and they're run down. But these 2 kids, the 8-year-old gets his 6-year-old brother up in the morning, they dress them. There's never any food in the house because they have two drug-addicted parents. They're lucky in some senses, you can argue, because they have 2 parents. But they're both drug-addicted, they're both heroin addicts. They don't know what time of day it is, they don't know what month it is. And these 2 kids, the elder one acts really as a parental figure to the younger and normally gets them off to school. But this particular day he'd learned of the breakfast club at the Baptist church. There is one further away on the estate, a bit further away than he would normally go. And hearing of that, they had headed over there, but they had no idea of time, so they got there around about 5 or 5.30. The breakfast club didn't open until 6.30. It was in the middle of winter. The weather actually then was not much different from the wind chill that was going on here, except in Glasgow, invariably, it's quite wet as well. So these 2 kids stood outside the Baptist church for 3/4 of an hour until the minister, a chap that I know very well, a chap called Sandy Weddle, happened to be coming to open the club. He took them in and he discovered their life story. And it's not untypical of many in that area. They've become very close friends, and he looks after them. So as our recent report on housing also shows, we have entrenched poverty in our social housing areas. We call them estates. I'm told not to use that phrase here because that sounds elitist. So I should use the word projects. But anyway, either way, these are social houses. And the majority of this poverty is concentrated in and around these social housing projects. These are people who are left behind now by the rest of society in a way that would have been unimaginable 20 years ago. On these estates, there is a culture thriving on welfare dependency. and far from progressive social housing estates, these move people from dependence into independence, you would hope. Not so, quite the contrary, it reverses it. It's actually moving people from independence to dependence. Basically, most of the people there are trapped there. The characteristics of such an estate, such a project, is that the tenants are workless, fatherless, and static. In 1970, just 11% of the households in such social housing were workless, just 11%. Today, only a third of those who live in these houses actually have full-time work. Around three-quarters of the households on these projects are headed by lone parents or single men and single women. That's all that are getting houses now. Unless you believe absolutely in the Immaculate Conception for everybody, I'm not going to question you on that one. The truth is, I think some of those lone parents have something to do with some of those lone men, but I may only be guessing. Only 15% of social rented households are headed by a couple with children, only 15%, and more than 80% of social housing residents in 2006 had been in that sector 10 years earlier. So static and broken. And the interesting thing is, it takes us now two houses to house a family. That's the point that I'm making about the relationship between these children. No wonder there's a demand for housing. Violence on these areas is a daily reality. We've just done a report on street gangs. Most crime is committed in Britain by Britain's poorest people, and strangely enough, it's committed against most of Britain's poorest people. I talk about the middle class as being worried about crime. We're the ones that bar our windows, alarm our houses, and call for more police, and crime is rising in these areas. But the truth is, you're more than likely, if you live on one of these social housing projects, to be living next door to somebody who is likely to be trying to burgle you, or somewhere along the line. You worry about your child, not because it's an abstract, but you worry about your child because it's a reality, and the street gangs that prevail in these areas are genuine, are nasty, and are very violent. And our recent report on street gangs found that these communities have become now a breeding ground for youth violence, which is played out very much by these territorial and violent gangs. And I go around and I talk to a lot of these people. I spend a lot of time in communities like this. And I'll find an example the other day that I was with a lone parent in a housing estate, a housing project rather, in Kent, which is actually a part of quite a middle-class area. But in the middle of this is this housing project that actually has the highest number of lone parents concentrated in one area in the whole of Europe. And I found a most remarkable lifestyle. I found that this young girl of 19, the same age as my daughter, my daughter's at university with her whole life ahead of her. This girl has a child of 1.5 years old. She has no job, little training, she's trying. But her family relationships intrigue me. Her mother, who is in her 30s, is living with another man who's about her age, about 19. She has about three children. Her daughter and her second daughter is 17. She has a child and another one on the way. Her son is 16. And he's living with a 30-year-old. I don't know whether they had a child on the way. And the mum, as I say, is in another relationship with somebody younger. And they all live within three blocks of each other. And they don't really get on, the mother and the daughter. And there's little help. Those families are passing down no parenting skills whatsoever. And the child that is born to that daughter, unless something changes in her life, is going to repeat that exactly as she has found it. And that is the point about this. As Bob Holman, a great friend of mine, who, by the way, would describe himself as a socialist, in case anyone worries that our friends do not cover the spectrum, has had a huge influence over some of my thinking in terms of where the problems lie. And he told me that the inner city is not a place, it is a state of mind. And I know what he means by that. And you should understand what he means by that. But actually, it's not limited any longer by the boundaries that we set around it. We've tried to ghettoize these places, but it doesn't work, because the inner city comes to call. As I said earlier, you worry about your barring of your houses, you worry about your daughters or your sons or your wives or your husbands or your boyfriends or your girlfriends coming home late from work or being on the street late at night in a way that maybe we didn't 20 or 30 years ago. And all that worry and that concern and that expenditure, that is actually what happens when the inner city comes to stay. It's a state of mind because it now bothers you. And you can do one of two things. You can try and arrest your way out of it, or you can try and deal with the causes, and I want to come to that. So I made a promise to many of the people that I met that I wouldn't just leave them behind, as too often many of my colleagues and myself do, after the cameras were gone, I'd come back and we'd commit ourselves to finding some of the solutions. And I think, furthermore, understanding the nature of the breakdown is critical for this reason, that because as I become more aware that successive governments have approached welfare reform in every time trying to reduce the costs, I understand now more and more that they've approached it from fundamentally the wrong angle. Every government is concerned, left or right, that the budget has grown. Successive governments talked of cutting the bill of social justice. But the problem is why that doesn't work. No government I know has ever reduced the social security bills. They almost always rise, and this last government has nearly doubled them in 10 years in the UK, from about £100 billion to £200 billion a year, over a third of government expenditure. The reason why this growth has gone on is that if you keep looking at welfare from the standpoint of the state, you will never get this right. The truth is that most welfare in the United Kingdom is actually delivered by families and extended families and by communities, without which the government could simply not cope. The welfare state is nothing more or less than a reaction to what is going on in the welfare society. If the welfare society is incapable of delivering for one reason or another, then the state is invited in. And it is when the state is invited in that we pay more taxes for that reason. So families, communities and charities who deliver the vast majority of welfare beyond the state are critical to a cohesive society. And this crumbling on the margins of this group has led to the growing demand, which is fueling cost. And while this process is damaging to the social structures of our society, there is a cost imperative. For those who are only interested in that, here's the deal. The cost of our fractured families, of poorly educated workers and dysfunctional adults is rendering Britain's economy, I think, absolutely uncompetitive. We just produced a paper called Bankrupt Britain, which you can get on our website. And this report talks about the real problems that we face as the economy goes into recession with this residual cost base, that no matter what you do about it, there is a residual number of unemployed people, which I'll talk about in a second, who cost you money regardless of whatever else you do and whatever else happens to the economy. And government departments foot the bill for lifestyles related breakdown from one financial year to another. The cost of social breakdown in the UK, we estimate, this is probably a conservative estimate, of some £102 billion a year. This is fueled by family breakdown at the heart of this, which costs the Exchequer over £20 billion a year now and rising. And this is spread across the whole benefit system, the education system, the care system, the National Health Service, the criminal justice system and elsewhere. Dave talked earlier on about how different family groups are more likely to have particular requirements. It is a fact of life that groups in the sort of areas that I'm talking about with dysfunctional families will have a greater call on health service, will have a greater liability to ill health, to poor future lives, and these all cost the state beyond even the calculations that I've made.